Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, we cross the line, if there is one, between politics and religion, and visit with Rabbi Phil Posner to consider, among other things, ethics and moral courage. Rabbi Phil Posner is the author of a fictional historical encounter entitled Food for Thought, Character, and Soul, where he gathers well-known historical figures, including Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Desmond Tutu, Jimmy Carter, and Bill and Hillary Clinton, to discuss empathy, justice, and moral courage. Our conversation, recorded on October 20th, 2008, began when I asked Rabbi Posner about his intention in creating this unusual book.
Once I decided that I wanted to do a book that dealt with character ethics, I needed to find or come up with people that, for me, personified the various chapters on moral courage, forgiveness, righteousness, justice, empathy, and compassion. So it was then just a matter of saying, well, Oprah Winfrey certainly fits the chapter on kindness, as does Mr. Rogers. As a matter of fact, that chapter on kindness takes place in Oprah Winfrey's Rose Garden in Santa Barbara with Mr. Rogers. And so while we're dialoguing about kindness, we're eating their favorite foods.
Well, what is the message that you're seeking to tell your readers?
That good food and character sustain us. Obviously, character sustains us as human beings. It contributes to the largesse of our own values and imprints itself on society at large. And food as well sustains us, not only physically, but also emotionally.
So how do you define character?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure I've been asked that before. To me, character represents those virtues that help us as human beings and contribute to better society as well.
So what would those virtues be?
Well, for me, the chapters are moral courage, forgiveness, righteousness, justice, empathy, and compassion. So those are character virtues or ethical values that I've decided should be in my book. And one of the really difficult decisions was, well, what character virtues am I going to choose? For example, I did not choose honesty, even though it's a wonderful virtue. I tried to choose virtues, values that are universal. Hitler was very honest. Honesty in and of itself is not, for me, enough of a categorical universal virtue, whereas compassion, kindness, moral courage, even forgiveness, etc., righteousness, have a universality to them of ethical virtue.
So within the social circles that you invite to each of your chapters, with the given names that you've just shared with us, you bring out a point. You create conversations between some living people and some people who are no longer living.
Right.
What kind of research were you able to do to identify the specifics, the stories that the people would tell?
Well, Barry, that was the fun part of writing the book, was the research, because it's basically biography, autobiography, and some online kind of information, and some personal interviews. The answer to the question is biography and autobiography, and history, because Joseph of the Bible, influenced on the text by looking at the Torah, reminding myself of the forgiveness qualities of Joseph, for example.
Tell us some of the stories that you have woven together around the dinner table.
Each one has its own kind of story. So it's kind of difficult for me to do that. But the chapter, for example, on kindness, as I said, takes place in Oprah's garden. And we're dialoguing about the nature of kindness. The chapter on moral courage does have a story because I use the theme of energy to describe a virtue of moral courage as seen in the need for a healthier universe and a better use of how we use energy sources. So I do create a story in that.
Tell us the story.
It takes place in an ex-gas station, and I'm pulling up to put gas in my car, and then I feel a tap on my shoulder, and my son Micah, who is a well-known bicycle activist in Santa Cruz, who doesn't drive a car and is very not too disposed with any kind of favor to cars, taps me on the shoulder and says, "Dad, there's no gas in this gas station." And then I lead the readers into a meeting with Mahatma Gandhi, Anwar Sadat, and Senator Robert Norris, who's in JFK's Profile of Courage. And while we're talking about moral courage, I weave this idea of energy. I don't really want to give away what the healthy energy source is, but it's definitely kind of weird. And I have to admit, it was a fun chapter. I never dreamed I would kind of write a chapter like that using something that was so off the wall. So it was a lot of fun.
I heard you mention that Abraham Lincoln was one of the only presidents, if not the only president, who did not publicly affiliate himself with a church.
There's a lot of new research on this, and I deal with it in my chapter with Carter and Mandela and Lincoln, where we're talking about the nature of righteousness. This research suggests that Lincoln's family were of a group of people called the Melungeons, who came to America in the 1600s. Basically, they were what we would call Sephardim, or Turkish combination of Jews, Turks, and Arabs. And they moved to the southeast, the Carolinas, Virginia, etc., and maintained their culture for quite a few years, but eventually were absorbed into the greater, you know, population. Lincoln, according to the scholar who has written about this the most, suggests that Lincoln was of this group of people. And one of the factors in that is his parents were not married in a church. They were married in the home of a man named Mr. Barry, as a matter of fact. And Lincoln himself never really affiliated personally with a church. So Mary Todd, he would go because she would take him to, you know, have him go to church. But he personally never identified with a specific religion identity. He was a great scholar of the Bible. He had a wonderful sense of religious content in his life and the way he lived his life, obviously. But he never affiliated with a specific religion.
Can you tell us the name of the scholar in the book that she wrote?
It's Dr. Elizabeth Hirschman, and the title of the book is called The Last Lost Tribe in America. And she also did a project on the Melungeon people. It's called a Melungeon DNA Surname Project by Dr. Elizabeth Hirschman and Dr. Donald Panther Yates. They're the more recent scholars on this whole issue of Lincoln's Melungeon, in a way, Jewish root identity or background.
In many of my conversations with authors who set out to write a book that is more philosophical as opposed to scientific, they often say that the book turns out very differently from what their original intention was. Mm. Was that your experience?
I think definitely. So first of all, I never imagined I was going to write a book. But I think the joy I discovered in writing is that creative energy that just takes place. You're sitting at your computer or typing however you type, and the things that show up on the screen are just absolutely amazing. Did I say that? You know, did that come out of me? That such and such? It's just absolutely amazing. Another example of that would be just the content. For example, the chapter on social, economic, and equal justice takes place with President Teddy Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, and Emma Lazarus. And when I sat down to write that, I guess I'd watched Lou Dobbs on CNN recently, and he's not one of my, well, I have Teddy Roosevelt say, he sounds kind of pompous, doesn't he? It was really neat to do that scene with those three people in one of Lou Dobbs' meetings where he brings people together. so I could spin the issue of socioeconomic equal justice off what Lou Dobbs was saying.
Can you give us an example of what the people who gathered with you to discuss social and economic justice would say is necessary to achieve social and economic justice?
Well, you know, I have to say that the thesis of my book ultimately is the importance of empathy. And so I think throughout the book, and particularly in the last chapter, which is the chapter on empathy, I have to say that for me, empathy is the catalyst for those character ethical themes that are in my book. That is to say, a person who values empathy and feels suffering for other people, as he or she has experienced suffering in and of himself, is going to feel natural empathy for people who are deprived of social, economic, equal justice. So to answer your question, I think throughout the book, empathy is the catalyst for ethical virtue. And certainly, as I see it, Emma Lazarus, I chose Emma Lazarus not only because she was a great poetess. I think people know that her poem is on the base of the Statue of Liberty. Emma Lazarus had an incredible, wonderful empathy for immigrants who were coming to America. And Teddy Roosevelt, Allah Shalom, peace unto him, was talking about equal pay for men and women in about 1909. So T.R. had this incredible empathy for people who were being deprived of those things that he felt was important. A square deal, as he called it.
Well, at this time, in the fall of 2008, when our country is going through an economic catharsis and a convolution, how would you see the application of economic and social justice employed with empathy?
I think a greater sensitivity to the factors that are causing human suffering. Healthcare, I mean, just a perfect example. The fact that 25 million children don't have health care, and they and their families suffer sometimes terribly because of a lack of that. Empathy causes, hopefully, political leaders, as citizens at large, to feel a greater sensitivity to suffering in terms of the health and the caregiving community.
In the last chapter of your book, Empathy, you talk about Etty Helsman. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, Etty Helsman. I call her the 27-year-old Anne Frank, because so many people know about Anne Frank. I've never been in a setting yet, even with young people generally, who know who Anne Frank is. But people don't know about Etty. And Etty lived in Amsterdam, died in Auschwitz, just like Anne, and also was a writer. The difference was that she died, I think, at the age of 27 in Auschwitz, and she had been writing for quite a while. And we have her book is called An Interrupted Life, The Letters and Diaries of Etty Helsrum. The reason Etty is so important to me is because she has the most incredible sense of what I call empathic perspective. I tell us an incident where she's having to report at Nazi headquarters in Amsterdam, and the Nazi lieutenant or whatever is in particularly nasty Nazi mood that day, and he's ordering them about, and he kind of puts his hand on his pistol and says, you, and he, you know, get your hands out of your pocket, stand straight. And Etty says to herself, I wonder if the lieutenant had a fight with his wife this morning, or did his mother write him an unkind letter? And that's the way Etty dealt with suffering. She has this incredible sense of empathy for people, and so therefore when she's at Westerbork, which is the holding center before they were sent to Auschwitz, she's always there for other people, and she talks a lot about that. It's kind of like a very famous rabbi named Leo Beck, who was in the concentration camp and is known for doing so many wonderful, kind things for his fellow inmates. The difference is that Leo Beck survived. Etty did not survive. She really is my saint. And when I visited my wonderful friend Mother Antonia in Mexico, whom I consider to be the Mother Teresa of Mexico, Mother Antonia said to me, Rabbi, I'm so glad to be in your chapter on compassion, But where's Viktor Frankl? He's my saint. Viktor Frankl, the famous Viktor Frankl, who's the author of Man's Search for Meaning, a wonderful book. And I say, Etty is my saint. Etty's the person whom I most view as this inspiring, incredible human being who brought to her universe a sense of empathy and passion and style. And so I really, in that chapter, I kind of fall in love with Etty. And I actually, Elie Wiesel says to me, Rabbi, I've never met anybody who publicly says he's in love with another woman. So yes, Etty is my saint.
Well, Rabbi Phil Posner, I want to talk about what justice lacks. But before we do that, I'd like to say that on this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Rabbi Phil Posner, the author of The Rabbi and His Famous Friends. Invite you to their table, Food for Thought, Character and Soul, Recipes and Blessings Included. Rabbi Phil Posner, you say that compassion, kindness, forgiveness, righteousness, empathy are lacking in justice. So if we're talking about social justice, these elements which you mention...
Well, they're lacking in injustice. When there's injustice, there's a lack of empathy. When we have a more just-filled society, then there's a greater sense of, greater awareness of empathy.
Then we have to define what is a just law and an unjust law.
I have to say that's probably over my head, because that is a really complex... Because now you're going into the issue of law.
Well, I've been there before, and I do like to talk about it.
I don't know that I would have an answer for, off the cuff, of how to define that, the nature of that in terms of justice per se.
Well, I would say perhaps that... the doctrine of separate but equal access to public service based on a person's skin color would be an unjust law. Or perhaps some of the laws in some countries where women must wear burqas would be an unjust law.
Well, and I would agree. I have to say, I do try to deal with that in a dialogue between M.L. King and Teddy Roosevelt, particularly in the issue of T.R.'s relationship with the African-American community, having to do with a battalion of soldiers, basically took away their status with the army. It was very unjust and very unfair, and I have he and King talking about that. So I agree with you, but I just think that the issue of law in that that context is it's a very complex issue, because it has so much to do with society and culture. So I have to come back to, well, what allows us to define the nature of justice? And with apartheid, for example, the South African regime in that time believed, or let's say our own southern United States, believed that segregation was a just process. I have to say, for me, it was unjust because it lacked a sense of empathy and compassion for that child who had to be humiliated with his friends when he had to go to a water fountain that was separate from where his white friends could drink, et cetera, et cetera. So again, for me, if I get pushed on this, again, I guess I have to come back to this issue of empathy as what I view as a catalyst for relationships that are just.
Which, can we say, provokes or foments civil disobedience?
Or as a matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, but I spent 39 days in a penitentiary in Mississippi.
In 1961. Tell us about that, the Freedom Rides.
Exactly. There was an injustice that obviously pervaded the transportation system in the southern states. A lot of students from the north and African-American students from the south gathered together under the leadership or the sponsorship of the Congress of Racial Equality to integrate transportation facilities. So in my case, we took the train from New Orleans to Jackson, sat in a train terminal in Jackson, black and white together, you know that song as well as I do, and got arrested.
You were in Parchman Penitentiary in Parchman, Mississippi. What happened when you were there?
I have to say we were pretty lucky because we were treated as political prisoners. That is to say, we were not thrown in with the general population. I have a friend named Stephen McNichols, who was a freedom rider in Houston, and they were thrown in with the general population, and Steve was, you know, beaten up. Because we were basically political prisoners. We were kept from the general population, in my case, the white population. We suffered because they would hose us down when it was cold, turn off the air conditioning, deprive us of food, threaten us, harass us in the penitentiary. But there was an incident with African-American freedom riders where they were really mistreated in that same penitentiary.
What was responsible for your release?
We had to put up a appeal bond.
For each person?
Yeah, before 39 days was up. So if we didn't put it up, the sentence was 4 months and $1,000. Most of us were students, so we wanted to get back to school. So CORE wanted us to stay in for 39 days.
That was about 47 years ago. Where was that in relationship to your desire to become a rabbi, to engage in the philosophy that drew you to clergy?
Well, it had a lot to do with my being a rabbi, because my desire to be a rabbi was to help bring about what we now call tikkun olam, the world's repair. My mother was an active liberal in social causes. I remember as a kid, we carried picket signs in front of Woolworths in Santa Monica because they only hired African-Americans as custodians. I grew up in a liberal Jewish home where social action was important, and as I studied scripture, particularly the prophets, I came to be incredibly aware of the need for justice and righteousness, etc., as seen in the great ethical prophetic tradition of the Bible. So that definitely influenced my desire to be a rabbi.
And your book, The Rabbi and His Favorite Friends, comes now after your professional career is not over, but it's not quite as active as it was.
It's a nice way to say it, right? Yeah, no, I'm retired, right.
But you're still a rabbi.
Well, you know, like a Methodist minister, you're always a minister. But I chose to retire, and having written the book, I now have the pleasure of marketing the book.
So what drew you to write The Rabbi and His Famous Friends?
My doctorate is on, no surprise, on empathy, particularly how does empathy influence ethical behavior? The proof text for that, one of the famous ones in Scripture, is you shall treat the stranger as the homeborn, for you were strangers in Egypt. You suffered in Egypt. You know what it's like to be a slave or a stranger, and therefore you need to have a special sense of empathy and compassion for the servant or the orphan, the widow, the slave, etc. So that's what I call empathy ethics. Having got my dissertation, my clergy doctorate in that field, I always knew, I think subliminally, that I wanted to write a book on ethics. And then in the last 15, 20 years, I've been doing a lot of baking and cooking. One point, about 4 or 5 years ago, it occurred to me, 2 in the morning when my creativity usually works, that good food and character sustain us. So that's how that happened. And then I want to give kavod, honor to a great, great human being named Steve Allen, because you may remember that
I do.
Steve Allen had a wonderful program called Meeting of the Mind. He brought the Everyone was deceased. he would bring Napoleon, Plato, and Jefferson together and lead a discussion, and he was an absolute genius at that. I decided to do a similar kind of thing, but I wanted to also bring in contemporary people like President Jimmy Carter or Nelson Mandela, etc.
Do you have other books in the works?
I'm beginning to think about, I really believe that character education is so important in our schools, and I'd like to hope that maybe someday I can be creative enough to do something like that for children, a book that deals with character and food, but it's more geared for children.
Well, Rabbi Phil Posner, author of The Rabbi and His Famous Friends, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting concept or idea that you've learned recently?
Well, as a matter of fact, I I really want to go to my book and to my son, Hillel, who loves to challenge me. First, I'm really grateful. Both of my kids do, but my Ukiah son, Hillel, especially. Empathy cannot be disassociated from the issue of suffering. We suffer, and hopefully we therefore have a greater sense of empathy. And Hillel has been saying to me, Dad, for you, suffering is so important. Why aren't you a vegetarian? That idea, I mean, I've always known about vegetarianism, but I haven't really struggled with it personally. Hillel really has challenged me with that idea, and I'm really thinking about moving in that direction because I think there's a need for integrity in terms of who we are as human beings. And if I'm going to talk about the importance of suffering, then I need to be more attentive to the animal kingdom and what we eat and what we don't eat.
Is your son a vegetarian?
Hillel is also struggling with this and moving towards that direction, yes.
And then I'd like to ask you about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, I am right in the midst of reading a wonderful book that's just, I've enjoyed it so much. And somebody in my town in Mexico, I live in Ajijic, Lake Chapala, said to me, you know, Phil, I have a book that you really would enjoy. And it's called Van Loon's Lives. Van Loon is a Dutchman who is both an illustrator and a wonderful author who brings together people like this chapter I'm looking at, William the Silent and George Washington. And he also does a dinner with them. So it's very much like my book. I had never heard of this book until after I wrote my book. I wish I had read it before because there are some things that I might have done differently having read Van Loon's Lives. But it's beautifully written. It's illustrated. And the guy's a genius. I mean, he has a tremendous command of history and philosophy and values. I'm showing Barry right now an illustration that Van Loon did as well. So I'm really enjoying this book.
Well, Rabbi Phil Posner, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, thanks for having me.
Rabbi Phil Posner is the author of Food for Thought, Character, and Soul. You may obtain a copy of this book from his website, rabbiposner.com. That's RABBIPOSNER.com. The books that Rabbi Posner recommends are Van Loon's Lives by Hendrik Willem Van Loon and Melungeons, The Last Lost Tribe in America by Elizabeth C. Hirschman. And finally, An Interrupted Life, The Diaries of Etty Hilsum. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.